Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Delicious and smooth tequila, meaning harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We would like to take a moment to dedicate this episode to all of the victims of gun violence over the last few weeks. It's been hard for us to wrap our minds around it, from Uvalde to Buffalo to Orange County, and even more. It's absolutely devastating. There are a lot of resources out there. Call your senators, call your congressmen, make some noise. And if you need to take a break, remember, you can always turn off social media and just take some time for yourself. We are excited to welcome Kaoru Mitsui of Seichi Me Magazine to Snacky Tunes. We chatted with her while she was in New York via Japan about her work as a food coordinator in Japan, starting career as a caterer, and then falling into a very specialized, very beautiful cross intersection of food and photography and writing. She has a new magazine out, Seichi Me Magazine, that's limited edition. Find it where you can, and I guarantee you, you'll be happy that you have it on your shelves at home. And then we dig into the archives and have a fun, really energetic performance from Moon Hooch, one of our more uplifting performances, which we thought would be something that everyone could enjoy today. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on heritageradionetwork.org.
We'll be right back.
Haru, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to sit down and chat with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be on your show.
You have done an absolute beautiful job of mixing food and art and using ingredients as materials like paint or sculpture through these pieces of food in your work. Mm-hmm. How do you seamlessly blend these two worlds? Where do you see them overlap?
I think it is the way I look at the ingredients and the food. I've always loved cooking, of course, but I've seen a lot of different characters while I look at the ingredients or when I cook. And during the process of it is the most of the time I realize very interesting details or unique characters in the ingredients themselves. So I think I'm very much inspired by those realizations I get. Yeah.
It's very inspiring and it's a lot of fun, but it's also not just fun because I really feel that you have an understanding of food and the ingredients you're working with. And I know that at the start of career, you were a caterer. How did you get involved with that type of work? What drew you into the world of cooking?
So I was first working as an office lady. We call that in Japan, where you work for a corporate company. And that was not my desired job, but I ended up there. And I suddenly got this very serious sickness, which I had to be treated for about half a year. In the hospital? Yes. Thank you. I wasn't able to get out of the hospital at all. So it was a very heavy treatment. And when the food there in the hospital was very, disappointing, kind of, gets you feel more worse in mentally, And the thing that I live in Japan and I'm a Japanese, but so the hospital was in Japan. And the thing that kept me energized were these pictures, photographs that I took at the Union Square Farmers Market years before that. And I always put those pictures beside the wall and would look at them and get very energized. And so after I was out of the hospital, the treatment was over. I started cooking at home because that was the only thing I could do. I wasn't able to go around outside that much. So I started cooking, and then I started posting those photographs on Facebook back then. It was cooking for all my friends that came to visit me. And it was pretty unique photographs, even when I look back at it right now. And this editor of my brother's friend, she kind of knew me, not directly that much, but then she one day found those photographs on Facebook and just told me to come work with her on this food styling job. So that was the very beginning. And then when I started that, I don't know why, but a lot of other people surrounding the food industry contacted me through Facebook, and they were, you know, design apparel companies that wanted me to cater for them because I had this a bit of unique world that I put on Facebook. So using food. So that's how everything started at once. Like, yeah. And I took every job I can and kind of lied that I can do everything.
Sure. Yeah. Get your foot in the door.
Yeah, because I had no connection to the food world. I only loved eating and cooking for myself. So, you know, it was like, take job, every job I can. Just pretend until you look very professional. Yeah.
But, you know, you seem to have some sort of knack for it because you eventually became a private chef. And
yes,
it's one thing to work as a caterer and just to put out a bunch of food and mm-hmm. – I don't want to see be faceless, but you know, you're not really having that directive relationship with your client.
Yes.
When you're a private chef, it's mm-hmm. sometimes you and a family or you and a few other people.
Yeah.
How did you build your skills, and eventually how did you get into the world of private chefing?
So as I started my career that way and proceeded to do all the jobs, you know, there were a variety of jobs. I was doing food styling, sometimes food directing, then catering, and also recipe developing and all this stuff for TV, sometimes commercials. And then I realized one day when I was catering for 100 people by myself because I didn't have an assistant, and I was still cooking at my parents' house. And then I had another kitchen that was approved, of course. But then I realized it was too much for me and I wasn't appreciated that much. I just deliver food and then everyone on set is always very tired and they just come to feed their appetite. And I didn't feel, as you said, that much connection to them. But I put all my heart and soul into that food. So I thought, oh, these making commercials or one very interesting visual, like photo shoot, is more I don't know the word, but more fulfilling for me. And it feels very good to work with creators that I admire, and we are kind of going towards the same direction and trying to create one thing that's amazing. And I really love that. So I kind of shifted that way, and I'm kind of making this story long, but so I stopped catering at that point. But by then, I had few clients that really loved my flavor or the taste of my food. And so they still wanted me to cook for them. So I said, if I feel like I'm directly connected with them and I can see their faces while they eat in some way, or get a feedback directly from them when I cook, that would be amazing. So this celebrity, they're a celebrity couple in Japan. They just asked me to cook at their home at this at their birthday party one time. And that was already 6 years ago or something. And since then, they've always called me to cook for their Christmas party every year. Since Corona, they had to stop because, you know, of course. So, but yeah, last October for Halloween, it was, you know, I went catering after a while. Yeah, after Corona. Yeah, that was the first time I went to their place again to cook.
Sometimes all you need is that one client and that one dinner, and it changes your life forever.
Yeah, I feel very grateful for, you know, they're very good people, and I feel very happy when I cook for them, and they have a lot of people come to eat my food, and she would always explain that it's made by me, and you know, she really appreciates the food, so I feel very happy. Yeah.
During this time, were you still doing photography on the side? Mm-hmm. Were you keeping up with your other passion?
Yes.
At what point did you start to see the merging of the world? Because now it's easy to see and know that you've been printed and it's in magazines and you're like, oh, this makes total sense. Mm-hmm. But it's another thing with your, especially with your series Food on a Photograph.
Yes.
How did that idea come to be, and what was that moment of inspiration like?
I feel like it has always been the same for me, especially in Japan. Food styling is, I would say it is not a singular job. We call it food coordinator, and it includes everything from recipe developing to styling to prop styling to everything. And since it's a lot, variety of jobs, it seemed to look like every cookbook or every food photography, to me, it looked very similar in a way, because one person does everything. And most of the time, clients want the same thing, delicious looking food, and people go towards that direction. But since I didn't have any mentors in Japan, I always felt like I wanted to do something very different from what everyone was doing. And I was always struggling to find what that was. And back then, when I first came up with the idea of Food on a Photograph, was exactly the time. It was almost 3 years when I started food styling. And one day I had this avocado toast in my hand, and I wanted to take a photograph of it, but I didn't feel like I wanted to just take a photo of it. And then I thought, I love Audrey Hepburn. I have her photo book, and why not, you know, express her beauty with food? And I don't know, it was kind of a crazy idea, but I just started putting food directly on that photo book that I destroyed, I think, by doing that every page, because it got wrinkled and it got soaked and everything. But I didn't even have the idea to print it out back then. I just really directly put it on the book. But right. I thought it was very fun. And it was in a way to kind of release all my stress with the work that I was doing. Like, I wanted to be more creative, kind of feeling. Yeah, that was the beginning of it. Yeah.
Mm. Well, let's take a quick musical break, because I want to get into the release of your zine and how you brought all of your skills together, mm-hmm. and eventually the birth and the creation of Shimi Magazine.
Thank you.
We have a song from the archives, and then we'll be right back here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.org.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are chatting with food director Kaoru Mitsui, and we were talking about the birth of your Food on a Photograph project. And it's one thing to be in your home and to be putting avocados and bell peppers on books and creating this new type of art. It's a whole other thing to take that and share it out with the world and get a positive response. How did you make that jump? How did you take it out of your apartment and start showing it to people?
Yes. So it was only like a passion project for me. But then it kind of got realized on Instagram, especially when it got to Victoria Granoff, which is in my mind, my mentor in the States. She's a renowned food stylist. And she reposted one of my posts on Instagram from Food on a Photograph. And I was so surprised that she did it. And at the same time, I felt pretty confident that this is something very unique. And then I kind of got the confidence to make it into a zine. And why not just bring it to New York, where, you know, the food scene is very interesting all the time. And so I think I really immediately put it together into a zine. And I was going to kind of give it out for free to everyone in New York.
Sure, sure.
But then this bookstore, Kitchen Art and Letters,
legendary.
When I brought it to them. So when I brought it to them, Knock, the owner back then, he passed away recently. But he told me, this is such a unique book that you've made and that you should sell it, because something for free isn't actually going to be respected that much. But this work is very should be respected. So that was another shocking thing for me to have a feedback like that. And yeah, that's... that brought me to so many other projects, because
it sold out. Yeah, it was a big success.
It was a huge success that this magazine in Japan, Anna Magazine, they wanted to have a whole feature of new works of mine with a collaboration with the model called Pojo in New York. So Anna Magazine gave us about 12 pages for us to do the whole feature of Food on a Magazine. Pojo is a model that is based in New York, and she has a content called Models That Eat. And she found one of my zines in McNally Jackson, and she contacted me and said we should do something together. And so I came back to New York and shot eight with all her model friends. And she shot with her film camera, and she sent all those pictures to me in Japan. And I printed them out and put food on them. And we had a pretty big exhibit back in Japan. Yeah.
So much of what you've been talking about mm-hmm. has a physical nature to it.
Yeah.
Printing things out, mm-hmm. zine, ingredients. Mm-hmm. When so much of the world has shifted to digital, what keeps drawing you back to this physical touch?
Mm-hmm. I think it's very important to have physical connection to things, especially in this day and age. Because as you said, everything is digital and goes away so quickly that I really think it is important to realize what you own and physically own, or you cherish, or you treasure, is because what you own is what you are. And also having a physical connection to people and things makes you very rich in a life-wise as a person. So when I make things, I feel like it should be something that people would want to hold on to and not just, you know, look at it and put it somewhere or throw it away, or, you know, you might sell it right after you bought it. because I feel bad when I do that, and I don't like to do that. And whatever I buy or I own, I really want to keep it for a long time. Yeah. Yes.
So you have the zine, you have this really successful show in Japan. When did you start thinking about what your next big project would be? And mm-hmm. how much of it, you know, you talk about this role of the food coordinator, mm-hmm. but it seems like that role of writing and photography and shopping and art directing and everything coming together mm-hmm. was leading you to what would eventually be Sashimi magazine. Mm-hmm. When did you start thinking that you wanted to put out your own much larger magazine instead of another zine, despite mm-hmm. its success?
Yes. It was very, so for me, I've always wanted to have my own cookbook published, but this idea I always had was that I wanted it to be something in a mix of cookbook and an art book, and maybe have fashion essence to it as like the food on a photograph. All these genres mixed together, because I don't see those kind of magazines in Japan. And so I always was waiting for the right timing to make this kind of book. But, and there was a timing where I had the opportunity to pitch for this book company in Japan, but the vision that I had was too unique for them, that, you know, it is pretty risky to, you know, publish this kind of book. So, but I wanted it to be in the best quality as possible. So I thought, okay, I should just do it by myself. And of course, not only me, but by the help of all these artists. But, sorry, what was the question?
I forgot. Oh, no, just I think it's just the journey here, just to say you carved your own path and yes. you didn't see anything, and you didn't have a mentor yes. or anyone saying like you can and can't do this. And you've created this yes. beautiful original type of magazine, mm-hmm. which had you taken a more traditional path, you probably wouldn't have wound up with.
Yes. And also, it was very important for me, even though this book, Sashimi Magazine, a publication, it looks like a book, but I call it a magazine because of several reasons. But mainly it was because I wanted it to be something to connect with people. A book is very good, but it's also like one project is done, then it's kind of over. But for me, this magazine, I will want, this time it's all created by Japanese artists, art directors, photographers, costume designers, all these very creative and upcoming and already successful photographers and everybody. But next time I might be working with people in a different country. That kind of ongoing project that people would be connected with and kind of create like a nice platform is what I wanted to do. So by doing only one book I felt like that wouldn't be able to make that kind of platform. So, yes.
I love the idea of doing a book and calling it a magazine and saying there's yes. more to come, that it's a series.
Yes.
And you've also shown your love of texture mm-hmm. and your love of a physical touch in the actual production of it.
Yes.
With the book, it's something beautiful to hold in your hands.
Yes. So this magazine is all separated. Each paper is a separate print. And so in a way you can customize all the pages in your desired way. Like if you want the recipe part to come on front, or you want to put it in the kitchen, you can pull out those papers and put in your kitchen, or you can take out the beautiful photography and frame it and put it on your wall and enjoy it. The thing is that you can have a physical interaction with the book, and also it is a it is able to for you to upcycle it in a way. Not only having it as a book in your shelf, but you can always take out and look at one page, and sometimes maybe you want to just pin it on the wall and stare at that ingredient photograph. Or and I think, yeah, and one page has my sewing work on it. This is a limited edition of 500, and each copy be sold, so you'll definitely feel the physical connection there too.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing. Now, speaking of ingredients, I had was reading some of your articles and read that you have a huge love for corn.
Yeah,
which, you know, this time of year in America, corn is where it's at. If I see corn or tomato on a dish during this time of year, I'm ordering it. What are you looking forward to this summer with corn? Do you have any plans with it, just to eat it, work with it? Maybe it's inspiration for your next project.
Corn. So the recipe that I put on this book was inspired by a sweet in Japan, sweet dish called denzai. And denzai has the base of it is a sweet red bean paste that's turned into a soup with water. And it's cold and it has a tiny mochi in it. So I thought the sweetness of that red bean paste is kind of similar to the very sweet corn in Japan. We have very, very extremely sweet corn right now because people are making new types of corn.
Sure.
And so the sweet corns, maybe I want to use it raw this time because in Japan it's not that common to use corn raw. So people always cook them, boil them moistly. But this time I would maybe make a Japanese version of that Mexican corn salad, balsamic.
Oh, yes, an elote salad.
Yeah, use some Japanese herbs like shiso and mioga is one of my also favorite herbs during the summer. So, yeah.
I love it. Well, Kara, thank you so much for making the time to chat with us. Congratulations on the release of Sichi Me magazine. If people want to pick up one of the very few copies that are available, where can they go? Where can they order? Where can they get their hands on it?
So the main place that you can get is Kitchen Art and Letters, and they just announced yesterday that it is going to go on sale, start selling on their website, and it sold out immediately.
Amazing.
So now they have a back order, and you can order there, or you can have McNally Jackson in Soho will have it. Yeah.
Amazing.
And also in London, yes, of course. In London, Mag Culture will have it. Yes.
Incredible. Well, I will definitely take you up on a copy because I missed the pre-sale yesterday. So I appreciate it. But listen, congratulations. Thank you for creating something so beautiful and for taking time to share some of the stories behind it. We have a song from the archives and a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
I had a stone to throw at something real, a treasure of my own, so I could feel. I dropped an anchor in the sand and watched it drag on through the sea. The shackles are off my hands, but I such a lovely shade of blue. Help me down, don't pick me up. Give me something that I can touch just the way here I've loved you all along. The summer came in fast, but it hasn't learned to last. It came to town just to turn you brown, then it passed. And now I'm freezing in my car as I'm driving under the stars. I've been thinking of you like I tend to do in the dark. I guess I never learned to choose. Help me down, don't pick me up. Give me something that I can touch. Just the way here I've loved you all along. Help me down, don't pick me up. Give my hands a bit of love, just the way here I'll love you while you're gone.
I'm Chava Periván, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods that a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainably managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome, Moon Hooch. Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah, you guys can move a little bit closer to the cool. mic.
I have to say that you are my favorite buskers, and
thank you.
Hold on, let's step back. So we
I can't start with compliments.
Well, no, you can start with compliments, but Darren and I were, you know, we live off the L train, and I transfer at 14th Square, and like I saw you guys play, and I was like, man, like I see a lot of buskers, but like, what are these guys doing down here? Like, this doesn't make any sense. They're a little bit too, you know, they're not playing a pan flute. And, like, I really felt that you guys should be, like, above ground. And then we started talking. I was like, dude, I saw this band. He's like, was it Moon Hooch? I was like, yeah, it was totally those guys. So eventually we were like, we got to just get these guys on the show. And then I saw you play, like, a few weeks ago on a Friday night. I was coming back from dinner. And it was a literal just dance party at 14th Square. People were just skipping their trains just to dance. First off, how often does that happen?
Every weekend if we play there. But we don't play every weekend, so it's kind of irregular.
Yeah, recently we've been playing at Union, actually Washington Square Park, under the arch.
Who do I have to go beat up if they like move you away from my train stop?
Well, it did happen already. The police has been cracking down all the buskers at 14th Street, Union Square.
Yeah, they're like... They're trying to stop.
Yeah. So lately, every time we played there, we were stopped by the police.
So let's step back. How do you become a busker in New York? And like, is it official? Is it scheduled?
Well, the way we do it is very unofficial. We just set up wherever and play. It's totally illegal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, there is like a program called Music Under New York, and that gives you like a permit to play. But you can't play on the subways, on the platforms. You can only play in the mezzanines.
Okay.
But the problem with this is the judges of the program are musicians themselves, subway musicians themselves. So they give themselves the permit. And we applied for it. We didn't get one. We didn't get a permit. So
is there a code of, like, is there a code? Because I feel that I saw you guys play there on, like, somewhat regular, basis. Like, is there a code, like, hey, man, we were here first? Or it's like...
Oh, like yeah. Other buskers?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's first come, first serve, really.
Well, it was really hard for us to, like, get accepted by the other buskers because some of them do this for, like, 10 years.
Right.
And, like, I mean, there was definitely a couple of occasions where we almost got in fist fights.
Yeah. Really?
Well, James...
we'll leave that story for off air. But so what is the... I mean, what is the history of you guys? Like, how did you form and how did you decide to go underground? Like, literally... Cool.
We all went to the New School for music together, and James and I were friends, but once in a while, I kind of knew each other.
Wait, take it around the room, because we didn't make an
appearance. Oh, yeah, James is the...
Hello.
He's the distant voice in the back.
Just the drummer.
I don't have a microphone.
Oh, no, it sounds good. It sounds good.
Yeah, it's good?
Yeah, it's good.
It's picking up.
Yeah.
Right. And so James, I'm Mike, saxophone.
I'm Wenzel.
Yeah, other saxophone. Other saxophone.
Yeah, and we went to school together. And James and I were playing, separately, and Wenzel was playing with James, and we were both kind of going down to the subway, but on like in separate groups, you know, just separate duos. And then one day we met in Washington Square, and James and Wenzel were playing Under the Arch, and I was with another drummer named Max, and we decided to play together, and a huge crowd formed around us, and we were playing housey dance music, because Wenzel has been producing it, and he said like, oh, I'll play in this key, something like that, and came up with a melody over it, and we got a really good crowd reaction, so we decided to keep going with it.
Yeah, I started just writing in the subway, on the subway rides to the platform, just little melodies and bass lines, just like I would do when I produce like an electronic song, like that kind of style, and showed it to Mike, and we just quickly learned it by heart and started playing. In the beginning, we only had like one or two songs, and like looping the same song.
it kept drunk people dancing.
Yeah, but I mean, if it's a subway platform, like you really probably like need like what, maybe like 22 minutes if it's late at night because the train's going.
Yeah, even less. I mean, 20. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'm being generous.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, now we have like a full like I don't know 2 hour set. With, like,
I mean, you have a full record.
20, we have another one ready, but we're going to work on it some more before we go in the studio.
And before we get into a song, where did the name come from?
Mike just blurted out one day. We were playing, we had no name, we weren't even considering ourselves a band, we were just all making money in the subway. and somebody asked us, hey, well, what's our name? And Mike just was in a goofy mood and said, Moon Juice. And we said, oh, that actually does sound like a cool name. And then we looked it up, and there were 8 bands called Moon Juice.
Of course.
And then,
obviously.
Then we went through the thesaurus and we found a replacement for Juice.
I mean, it is.
And then Hooch, and then it made sense. Like, oh, it's like moonshine.
Or yeah. No, it's good. Yeah. Let's get into a song.
Yeah.
All
right. Do a song. Which one are you guys going to play first?
Number 7, this one's called. Or Take the L Train.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Nice. I get the reference.
live on Snacky Tunes, Moon Hooch. It's about to get loud. I think that is the loudest that it's been in here.
No.
No?
Immaculate.
Oh, Immaculate. Yeah, I guess they had amps. But, all right, second loudest.
So dancey.
Yeah, so dancey. I mean, so how much of does your electronic house music background come to influence in writing your songs now?
A fair amount, actually. We all started listening to electronic music. I started listening to electronic music probably about 2 years ago. Wenzel's been doing it for like maybe 5 years. Mike, about the same.
Have you? 2 years. 5 years.
What? Listening or producing?
Listening.
I've been listening to.
I got really into electronic music when I started producing it. Like that's, I think, when I got.
When was that?
I don't know. When was it? Like, 2008 or seven? 2008 or nine.
A cruise ship. Cruise ship?
Yeah, I was working on a cruise ship, and I.
That's like 2009. Yeah.
What were you doing? You're just gonna drop that in there, like it's a comment. What were you doing on a cruise ship?
Well, I was actually working there as a saxophone player and flautist and clarinetist.
Oh, okay.
But my passion was not really the music we played there. It was just more like work, and I got to know the DJ of the cruise ship, and we just like started producing together.
Amazing. Yeah. So how did you go from busking to gigs, or were you also pursuing gigs like in clubs along the same time?
I think it's just that people see us on the train and literally drop their card or take our card or, you know, get in touch with us. And now we have a manager, so thanks so much.
Hey, by the way, thank you, Rich. He got back to me immediately.
Richard's the man. He's nailing it.
It's much easier now.
I can imagine. So, what was your first gig outside of busking together?
As first movies? Ever?
I remember it. You know where it was?
It was on the
rooftop of... What's her name? The Red Hair Girl.
Oh, that's right. Randall Wendell. Oh,
yeah. Randall Wendell, yeah.
Holy shit. Was that the first ever?
That was our first gig.
In Williamsburg,
exactly, that's right. Yeah. Because we never played a gig before, and we were like really worried we're going to run out of songs and whatnot, or people are not going to like it.
Repeat trick like you do in the subway.
Yeah, exactly. But it was really cool. Actually, people started dancing so hard, the roof almost collapsed.
Yeah,
but that was not because people danced. It was the roof was shitty.
Yeah, okay.
It was definitely quite an experience.
And then, you guys formed when exactly?
Somewhere in 2010.
Okay. Oh, so not that long ago.
No, we're newborns.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Not even 2 years. Yeah.
So, like, just to go back to the subway because it's such an interesting thing. We don't get to talk to too many buskers. Like, what was it like that you had to do to get accepted by the other buskers? And like, what were some of the trappings?
You know, they used to come at us, like, we play, and like a bucket drummer came, sat up next to us, and started playing a different tempo.
And yeah, they were like real rude about it, like super aggressive,
super sandbag,
so really aggressive.
That's aggressive.
And
it's not passive aggressive.
No, it's, okay, no, it's just
and,
like,
and then like aggressive. We said something like, "What do you want to play together?" Or like, "Do you want to?" Just wouldn't respond. I'm doing this for 10 years. Do you see the marks here? That's because I've made them. I've been here for 10 years.
Oh, the marks as the people watch.
And you know, yeah, it got really heated, the situation, and we left.
We ended up just leaving. And whatever, man, you can have it.
You know, just
we're not gonna
go through
those
situations over and over again, and then the other buskers actually listen to you, and then they actually, you know, we start liking each other, and now I feel like. Like the other buskers are our friends, and we say, "Hey, I'm gonna come back in 1 hour. Are you gonna be still playing?" Oh yeah, you know, it's more.
Yeah, we kind of just schedule it. You know, whoever's there first, like, and then we're like, "Yeah, so we'll be here until 10. You know, you can have it then."
Huh.
And
but so like all the people on like Bedford and everything, like that's also illegal.
Yeah,
as well.
Everything.
Yeah, everything is legal.
Well, what about those people in with the signs?
Well. You said that's part of the alliance, right?
Wait, that's on the mezzanine. The mezzanine with the music on the New York signs? Yeah, that's legal.
So what are the cops? Do they come and they're like, "You guys can't be here"?
It depends
on the cop. Sometimes the cops like our music and they just let us keep going. But sometimes they're like, they'll yell at us and be like, "This isn't a club."
That's so crazy. I mean, I feel like... Yeah, I mean, I guess...
Oh, really?
The thing is that it's not like a strict law. It's kind of like
ambiguous.
Area,
ambiguous, yeah. Because we don't have amplification.
Right, that's the one thing that we know. It's like no electricity...
Right.
But you guys are loud as shit.
Yeah,
so,
we're loud.
Like, the guy with the pan flute is definitely not going
to
start
it. He's got amplification.
Look at the one guy we saw, his pan flute's still attached to a microphone that he used to play off of. Which is kind of sad because it's like a yes-ear thing. And you're not really going to hear the theme to Titanic the same way without the backing tracks.
But
you guys are loud. So I can see how like they would be like, well... That's kind of not...
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, cops walk by and say, "I can't even hear myself thinking stuff."
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I mean, totally makes sense. Just...
So do you see, you know, as things progress, you know, leaving the subway and just playing more and more shows? Like, was this a stepping stone? Totally. Or
I mean, well, we have a residency right now.
How did the residency... It's at Knitting Factory.
Yeah.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, I got in touch with them... last year, because we're doing warehouse parties, and those became too dangerous, too illegal,
too much.
And too big, and we didn't want to have the responsibility anymore, so we want to contact clubs to play in clubs. And after, you know, talking a little bit to the knitting factory, they finally booked us, and the bartender and intern, who was Richard, figured out that we didn't have a manager, and he always wanted to be a manager, and he's really talented as a manager.
Wait, so what?
Sorry, I'm talking about...
No, I get it. So Richard was a bartender at
Knitting Factory. And the book, he did booking.
And he did booking.
And then he got us the residency.
And he's still working over there?
Yeah, he still works there too.
So, pretty good.
Pretty good.
Yeah, it's
pretty
great. Good. It's
extra drink tickets, right? Huh? Extra drink tickets?
Well, we got a bottle of Jameson in the green room.
Yeah. Hey, we're the same writer.
Same writer.
Well,
let's look at that song. Wait a second. How does the fee get negotiated? Does he just kind of like look in a mirror and be like, I don't know, man, it seems a little high. It's like, well, you know, they're a good band. They've been working hard.
No, he's not the manager at the Knitting Factory, so he has to negotiate with the manager at the Knitting Factory.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. All right, yeah, let's rip another tune. Rip another tune for this band.
Song from Miguel?
Yeah, that's why I've been saying it.
Yeah, let's do it.
This next one is called Song from Miguel. Miguel's a guy, really awesome man, who gave us our saxophones, actually.
He gave them to you?
Yeah, all of them. So, he's a man. Yeah, and they're like the best saxophones you can get.
Yeah.
So, thank you, Miguel. Always. Yeah.
Thank you.
barn burner.
Are they getting pissed off out there?
I think they're getting a little... I think it's a little loud. It's fine. I
think we'll maybe just keep it at those two songs, and we'll just kind of take it out.
Cool. Wait, can you go back to that story about getting the saxophones?
Yeah. When I was living in Portugal...
By the way, that sounded awesome. Yeah, that sounded really good. I just want to say that even though they went around and asked, everyone was like, no, we're totally cool with the music.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay, so you're in...
I was living in Portugal in 2007, and I literally received a phone call from somebody I didn't know, and he asked me, give me your address, and I said, why? And he's like, I'm in a divine mission, and you're the chosen. And, like, wow. I gave him my address, and a week later, this fucking crazy saxophone arrived. It's a con that's 60 years old. It's, like, a really rare saxophone that all the, like, famous saxophone players played on. And then I came to New York, and I actually got to meet the guy that gave me the saxophone.
Mm-hmm. Wait, how did he hear about you, though?
I played a jazz festival in Portugal, and a friend of his saw me and told him about me. And then I got to meet Miguel finally in New York, and he's like a really cool guy. He's a saxophone player himself, who got a lot of money by doing a translation company, and he's the most generous, amazing guy. And I just mentioned, like, I just asked him, like, what kind of brand of baritone saxophone should I get? I'm like thinking about buying a cheap one, and he's like, oh, you want a Barry? And I'm like, yeah, I have a Mark VI. Those are $12,000. They cost $12,000. There's this one right here.
It's like the best one.
He's like, yeah, I have it in Valencia right now. I get it to you by the end of the month. And he did. And then we played a party at his house, and he took... Well, Mike, do you want to tell that story?
Yeah, so we played a party at Miguel's house on his roof. And, you know, just having a good time. And then after we played, he's like, hey, Mike, I just bought a Sonny Stitt's horn off eBay.
Sonny Stitt's a really famous saxophone player.
Yeah. Like from way back. He's like, you want to check it out? I said, yeah, obviously. So I go down, and he's like, why don't you play it? If you fall in love with it, you can have it. It's like, oh my god. Okay.
So, who is this guy?
Jesus.
A good man.
This is the saxophone Jesus. But so we went to his room, and like a bunch of people came, and I played it, and I loved it. You know, it was just like the best one I ever played. And gave it to me that night. It was a trip. It was pretty weird.
Yeah. That was crazy.
The look on your face was amazing.
Mike started crying, I think.
Yeah. I cried a little bit.
Yeah, I would cry too. That's amazing. And it also, you know, shaped two-thirds of the band.
Yeah.
And the sound, like...
It's all I mean, vintage saxophones that we could never afford.
My one's from 1941.
Yeah.
And it's all coming from these two. Like, you couldn't recreate this with cheaper horns.
No, you could, but not
the same quality.
I mean, you can't. I mean, you can't replace a Mark VI. You know, you can't replace a Con.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So, you know, why don't you guys tell us about, you know, you have a show coming up in April, right?
Yeah, April 13th.
Knitting Factory.
Yeah.
Is it just you guys, or is anybody else playing?
It's just us, and it starts at 12 a.m. So,
midnight.
Midnight.
Oh, amazing. And then
is that the Thursday night or the Friday night?
Yeah, that's the confusion. But it's Friday night.
Okay,
yeah,
you can buy tickets online at Ticketfly.
I usually just try and tell people it starts at 11:59 on Friday night.
Yeah, right. I know 11:59.
Because then,
it always gets confusing. Yeah. 11:59. And then they don't. Friday night.
11:59, 59 seconds. You know,
might be a second. 59 seconds exactly. Yeah.
We take the stage, and then you guys have one record out already.
Yeah.
Where can you get that?
Yeah. You can get it on Bandcamp.
Yeah.
On iTunes, you can get it on Amazon.
Anything that you can buy CDs on.
Spotify, anything really.
Amazing. And then you said you have another record coming out.
Well, it's not coming out. It's just being produced right now by us.
We have about probably 23, 24 songs.
Yeah, we have
songs.
Another 12 songs.
Amazing.
But what we want to do for our next album, this album is totally acoustic everything. And for the next album, we want to elaborate on the sound a little bit, you know? Like,
we want to start incorporating electronic effects.
Or we've been also going to junkyards collecting metal, and, you know, we're planning on building percussion racks, and, I don't know, we maybe even incorporate, like, some rhythmic samples of a train, of a subway train, going through the tunnel in Bedford, you know?
Cut it up,
make a drum set out of it. Just, like, we want to experiment a lot with it and surprise our fans with our next
album. That's awesome. Bigger band?
Yeah, well,
we're gonna have some guests. We're gonna have a rapper. We're gonna have a singer that we're actually working on with right now already, and we're also gonna invite five saxophone players for one song or two.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So, why don't you give the nuts and bolts of where to find you guys online, Twitter, email, bookings, all that stuff.
Yeah. You can see us online. Facebook Moon Hooch or Twitter Moon Hooch, moonhooch.com. Or moonhooch.bandcamp.com. Just Google us. We're on YouTube.
Awesome.
So I think we're going to have to call it today.
Yeah.
This is the first time that's actually two of the owners are sitting out there of all the times that have come to play.
We'll do one more.
Is Roberto out there?
We're good on one more, guys.
Oh, we are good on one more?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Great. All right. So on the show. So thank you to everybody who was on the show today. Thank you for the fried chicken sandwiches from Smith Canteen, Searsucker. Are you going to be here next week? No, I'll actually be gone for the next few weeks. Next week, Jack, you'll be happy about this. It's a DJ set. Lemonade, our good friends Lemonade are going to come back. They're going to play a DJ set, talk about the new record they have coming out in May. And then, we'll be back with some more episodes of Snack and Tunes. And I'll be back in a few weeks.
Sweet.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
You going to be okay?
I guess.
I'll hug you after this.
All right.
Okay.
I didn't know you were going to be missing so many weeks.
Surprise.
Awesome.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Well, I'll be here.
For this next one, we're going to...
What is that?
Wenzel's sticking a cardboard tube in his saxophone, in the bell of the saxophone, to lower the pitch of the horn.
Yeah,
so
it makes the lowest note, a minor six lower.
And we're going to try and emulate some dubstep.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
So sorry, owners of...
No, it's fine. Moon Hooch, hey, they gave us the sign-off. Moon Hooch on Snacky Tunes. I'll see you next week. Greg will not. Have fun at Coachella.
I'll try.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.